We'll call Senate Resources to order. Can we turn off the jukebox?
Let me reach that for you.
Thank you. Thank you. First bill we have up today, present Senator Stevens, Senator Elton, Senator Wilken, myself, Senator Torgerson. We'll have a quorum until about 4 o'clock, and then Senator Elton has a previous engagement that he has to go to. So we will not have a quorum to move any bills today, but we are going to hear them, and we'll bring them up as soon as we can after we get done at our next meetings. The first bill up is Senate Bill 329, sponsored Senator Halford. It's an act authorizing community development quotas to hold commercial fishing permits. And Kelly gets to tell us all about it and answer all the tough questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kelly Hoover, staff to the bill sponsor, Senator Rick Halford. Senate Bill 329 provides an additional tool to the community development quota groups by allowing them to hold limited entry permits. Broadening the limited entry permitting process creates a mechanism that will allow the CDQ groups to protect their own region, get permits into smaller communities within their geographic bounds. It's an effort to bring new jobs and wages that will strengthen the economic well-being in communities of Western Alaska. Should this bill become law, limited entry permits would be held by individuals, CDQ groups, CFAB, and then other state loan programs. The sponsor recognizes that this is the first step in the process, welcomes the public comment that will be before you today, encourages changes that's going to strengthen the bill and at the same time prevent unintended consequences. So that's just a simple overview for you. I think that the bill's pretty self-explanatory. I understand that there's some folks that are going to testify that are going to bring some ideas forward, and the sponsor lets the committee take those on individually.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, thanks, Kelly. Let's go ahead and start here in Juneau so we can get the administration's point of view. I'll just go down the list. Bruce Tomley first with CFCC. Good morning or afternoon, Bruce.
Senator, thank you. I'm Bruce Tomley, chairman of the Limited Entry Commission, and I want to say that we support the goal the sponsor has stated for this bill. Getting permits into the hands of local rural residents is something that we have worked toward for a long time. What I want to say is, and I'm here basically to speak against the bill in its current form, but I want to say that there's the means to meet those goals under state law right now. There's a very effective opportunity that's available under the existing state commercial loan program. There's a special loan program that was created some years ago by Nels Anderson for rural residents. There's an opportunity for CDQ groups, whom the bill is about, to be partners in the process and to help get more permits into the hands of local people. They can actually promote local people for the loans. They can do the selection and work in partnership with the Division of Investments. I'd be happy to talk about that in more detail if someone's interested, but I wanted to get on with other comments and not take up too much time. The reason we feel compelled to speak against the bill basically comes down to two points. First, I think there are some serious legal issues raised by the bill. The bill would authorize community development quota organizations to hold limited entry permits. Well, CDQs are entities that are confined to certain limited geographic areas in rural Alaska. They're also composed entirely of Alaska Native villages certified by the Secretary of Interior. This is a very limited category of holders of limited entry permits. It's very restrictive. I think you can contrast it with the category that formerly governed the subsistence preference in Alaska. I mean, under our state constitution, a rural preference for subsistence was struck down. Now, that's a very broad, largely open category. The category being put forward in this bill is much more restrictive in terms of area, And in terms of the composition of the groups that can hold limited entry permits, the basic question I want to raise is, how would you defend this new category under the state constitution? And I'm not sure that can be done. The second question I want to raise is, why open the holding of limited entry permits to entities at all? I mean, the major step this bill takes would be to authorize an entity, a corporation, to hold limited entry permits. Going back to the time limited entry was created, one of the fundamental purposes of the act was to make sure that limited fishing privileges could be held only by real, live, individual fishermen. And the notion was that there was some history of exploitation of Alaskan fishermen by corporations, by other entities, and the idea was to help insulate Alaska fishermen from that by giving them total control of their fishing privileges so that they could conduct their own affairs, conduct their own businesses, have some bargaining power in the process. And I would submit that in the future, as we face various dislocations for the industry trying to adjust to a changing world market, that preserving that individual place for Alaskans in the fishery remains important. I mean, individuals, even though there may be any number of creative ideas where individuals could get together with CDQs could help open up new markets, I think that individual fishermen need to remain in control of their fishing rights so that they have some bargaining power in the process, so they can preserve a place in the process and not simply become an employee of a corporation. Now, so I think that issue remains important today. Beyond those comments, I have some technical comments about the bill, but I'd be happy to take those up with the sponsor and the sponsor's staff, unless the committee would like to get into them. But I'm happy to respond to any questions the committee may have.
I just have one, and I wonder if I can back you up to your. You said you were against the bill because there are certain things already available, and I wasn't writing fast enough. I only have loans. What else? You had a laundry list of things. What else is available now to people that?
Here's what's available right now. The state commercial fishing loan program is sitting there in Division of Investments. They have money available. They have a special loan category to loan money to rural residents so they can get limited entry permits. There's been an upper limit on the amount of money that was available for those loans. And today, with depressed permit prices, permits for the first time are within reach of this loan program. It's called the Type B loan program. Now, that's coupled with an opportunity for CDQ organizations to literally be a partner with the Division of Investments. All CDQ organizations need to do is deposit some money into an account where it can sit and collect interest and have that money available as loan guarantees. And then from there, they can work together with the Division of Investments, where Division of Investments does all the administrative work, handles the money, all of the detail work, and the opportunity for the local CDQ organization is to pick good candidates for the loans, people they know who can succeed as fishermen. It's a much better prospect than having a bureaucrat in Juneau pick an applicant for a loan, but it means local people, part of the CDQ, can do that. They can also pick people to stand in line to step in and assume the loan in the event that there's a failure of the original loan. But it's an opportunity. It's there right now. It doesn't require a change of law.
Okay. And the technical issues, I assume that they're small in nature, that so you don't want to bring them up?
I could mention a couple are small. One is two may be kind of significant. On page 1, lines 6 through 10, the bill would authorize CDQ organizations to hold interim use permits, and I'm assuming that's interim use permits in open fisheries as opposed to limited entry fisheries. And it's a provision that doesn't make sense to me because CDQ organizations can participate in open to entry fisheries now. I mean, they simply have to employ a captain, and a captain can buy an IUP. Anybody can buy an interim use permit to participate in those fisheries. The only way I can see that this makes sense is if CDQs under the bill would be in position to compete with individual fishermen for ultimate limited entry permits if the fishery were to go limited. And that may be the purpose of the bill, because at a later point in the bill, it turns up on page 7, lines 11 through 18, the wording there suggests that the CDQ itself could qualify for a limited entry permit on individual, on initial issuance by the state, just as individual fishermen can now. So that was an issue that concerned me. It may well be the intention, but I think one has to contemplate that limited entry only survives under the state constitution if it satisfies the two specified constitutional purposes. One of them being conservation of the fishery, the other one preventing economic distress among fishermen. And if you can't satisfy those two provisions, a limited entry system will be struck down. And I can't see from the bill that it meets either of those standards.
Okay. Other questions, Bruce?
Can you explain to me, or maybe the sponsor can explain to me why CFAB and the state loan programs would become eligible under this? Or what the intent of that was?
Senator, I'm not sure I understand the question.
The sponsor statement says entry permits shall be held only by the following list: individual CDQ groups, CFAD, and the state loan programs. I don't know. Is Kelly here?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that was just a list including CDQ groups and what limited entry already does. So the sponsor is just letting you know that a CDQ groups would then be among the list that could hold, if the bill passed, limited entry permits.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but CFAB is not now able to hold a limited entry permit.
That's true, Senator. They have a security interest.
They have a security interest against it.
Yeah, and so does the state loan program. But
what you're saying now is that there's nothing that prevents a CDQ group from having a secured interest on a loan now?
No. What they have is the opportunity to piggyback on top of the State Division of Investments program. They can do this with CFAB, too. They can join as a partner. And the Division of Investments has all the powers it has to loan money.
As long as you have a guarantor, right. So the CDQ group is the guarantor for the individual.
Right. And it helps make the money go further. It helps, in this case, it's under a program where no down payment is even required. But they can, by participating, help the money to go forward and reach more people. They can literally select the candidates for the loans. They can select substitute candidates to step in. They can do all the work that's relevant to local communities in terms of getting and keeping limited entry permits in the fishery, getting good local candidates into the fishery, and basically the loan program does all the work, all the grunt work.
What would be the security for the CDQ group?
The permit itself remains security. And that's where, because it's Division of Investments as a partner, they're authorized, along with CFAB, to actually foreclose on the permit.
Right.
But under the scheme, they wouldn't necessarily have to do that, because there could be another local person standing in line ready to assume the loan under this program. You wouldn't necessarily lose the permit from the local area.
More questions?
What in approximate numbers, what's the number of limited entry permits issued now for salmon in Alaska, do you know?
Oh, altogether it's about 14,000.
14,000.
Mm-hmm. And Alaskans...
And do you have a percentage breakdown for resident and rural resident?
I do. Alaskans hold about almost 78% of those permits overall. Now, more than... So Alaskans hold more than 78. I think that's more than 11,000 of the permits. And rural residents hold more than half of the permits held by Alaskans. That's the breakdown.
So I'm trying to get a little bit maybe too specific here, but do you have a breakdown of what that rural resident area or region is? So say western Alaska from north of the Aleutian Islands?
Oh, it varies from fishery to fishery. But right. If you look at some of the areas that are affected by this bill, if you look at Lower Yukon and Norton Sound and Lower Kuskokwim, The percentage of Alaskans holding permits there varies between 98% and 99%, and most of them are local people.
That's a small local fishery. Let's look at the money fisheries, for instance, Bristol Bay.
You get into Bristol Bay, and 72% of the SetNet permits are held by Alaskans. More than half of those are held by local Alaskans. In the driftnet fishery, it's a little more than 49%, close to 50%, which is roughly the historic percentage of Alaskan, non-Alaskan participation in the fishery. But again, more than half of those permits held by Alaskans are held by local Alaskans. It's in excess of 450 or so permits held by
for the drift permit?
For the drift permits. So there's an economic base there, an existing one. People haven't lost out on the fishery. It's a base you could build on. One of the things we helped encourage people to establish was a local permit brokerage to help more local people get limited entry permits. And actually, we've been working with the CDQ, and the CDQ representative, Robin Samuelson, has told me that they're right now exploring the kind of program that I have suggested to you could be productive in the Bay. They're looking at that and are interested in pursuing it.
So, that's okay. I'm off on another train of thought. I don't want to throw it out right now.
Any questions? Have you written up your testimony by any chance?
I have not, but I could if that would be helpful.
I think that'd be helpful in helping us work through the difficulties here, especially on the technical changes that you see in the bill or the problems that you see actually in the bill. So that would be, I think that'd be helpful when we bring this back up again. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Bruce.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, Steve White, Department of Law. Tell us how constitutional this is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Steve White. I'm Assistant Attorney General with the State Department of Law. Mr. Twomley has already alluded to the constitutional problems. I agree with him. We have a constitutional problem because CDQ groups have to be certified. One of the criteria is they have to be certified as Native villages under ANCSA. So, therefore, there's a Native or racial component to them. Federal government is permitted under its constitutional scheme to give preference based upon Native issues, but the state constitution does not allow us to do that unless we meet really strict standards under our equal protection and our uniform application clauses. Essentially, our courts would say, what is the purpose for this type of scheme? And if the purpose is to turn permits for residents, is there another way to do that without establishing essentially a racial classification or racial preference? And I think Mr. Twomley has already said there's other ways to accomplish that, so I think this would be very vulnerable under our state constitution. Also, I think it would also could be challenged under the federal constitution because it would also be giving not only a preference a racial classification or racial preference, but also to Alaska residents versus non-residents who are also commercial fish, and we get back into the whole privileges immunities clause problem that we're dealing with in Carlson case. So I think we'd be vulnerable there as well, because not only do the CDQ groups have to be Native villages certified, but they have to be local residents, that is Alaskans. So again, Alaskans would be given preference in this scheme versus non-residents, and even though we all like that idea, the federal constitution has problems with it. So I'm here to answer any questions on these legal issues.
Senator Elton. Two questions, Mr. Chair. Steve, one of the things that happens as you get older is your memory slips a little bit, but my memory of the debate in the early 1970s on the constitutional provision that allowed limited entry was that it was based on real people, natural people. The privilege of limited entry was to be accorded to them and not to entities or corporations because of the experience that the state had had, or the concern that many people in the state had about processors accumulating permits. And if my memory of that history is correct, I mean, is that one of the constitutional problems we've got, is people voted for this understanding that only real people would have permits instead of entities holding permits?
Through the chair, I'm not sure the constitutional history of the amendment which allowed limited entry, but I know that there was a lot in the sense of it being recognized as constitutional history, but I know that a lot of the impetus behind limited entry was to get the fishing industry away from being owned by the processors, particularly processors in Seattle, who had accumulated a lot of power through owning essentially the opportunities to fish and kind of sharecropping them out to the fishermen. So I think that was certainly in the minds of people when they went to vote for the exception to the exclusive right of fisheries clause.
And one other question that may be an appropriate one for an attorney, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I'm even using the appropriate legal term, but because this legislation is so narrowly drafted that only one kind of an entity would be allowed to accumulate the permits, and only permits from a very discrete region of the state. I mean, is there a problem with this being so narrowly drafted that you get into, I mean, is a term of art special and local legislation, or I don't know what the term of art is.
Through the chair, I think you have the right term of art. I didn't think of it in that regard. I think it's probably, I think it's general enough that we're probably past that constitutional problem. I think the other constitutional problems are a lot more severe than the local and special legislation.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, other questions? Thanks, Steve. Appreciate that. Jeff Bush.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jeff Bush, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Community and Economic Development, and I'm also a member of the state CDQ team. And it's in that capacity that I'm here today. I'm here, and I found, actually, I have to start off by saying I found the beginning testimony quite interesting and informative, and I'm here to say that, I guess, in contrast to Bruce Twomley's position, our agency at least is supportive of the philosophy behind this particular piece of legislation, but we share some of the same concerns in terms of the legal issues and truly believe that those need to be addressed. And I'm glad that Mr. White was here to do that. But excluding the legal concerns, or assuming that those legal concerns could be dealt with, our department at least is supportive of the concept of assisting CDQ groups, at least in terms of if the overriding philosophy or purpose of this legislation, as we understand it, is to essentially assist Western Alaskan communities in retaining permits in the regions and allowing fishermen in those particular communities to have more opportunity than they would otherwise to utilize these permits. Assuming that that's the purpose, and I think even Mr. Twomley would support that purpose, maybe we're only arguing here or disagreeing on how you accomplish that. But having said that, I think that this is a potential tool. I recognize the legal concerns. I'm certainly would oppose anything that would open up the limited entry program to larger entities or other entities such as fish processors, et cetera, from ever having an opportunity to get limited entry permits. That isn't the purpose here, and it is narrowly drafted to allow only for CDQ groups to have that right. I think that's important, and it's an important limitation that we would hope could be retained if it is to move forward. And with that, I guess I'd be available for any questions.
Any questions? Senator Altman.
Just one, Mr. Chair. I mean, you know an awful lot more about CDQ groups than I do, but CDQ groups are processors in one sense.
Through the chair, CDQ groups are, in all cases, nonprofit corporations. Their members are the communities that they represent specifically, and they have to actually select their board from the communities. And yes, as part of their businesses, they do processing.
I
I'm wondering how much of a problem we have if 99% of these are already owned by local rural residents. Doesn't sound like much of a problem to begin with. Is that your experience with dealing with the CDQ group?
Mr. Chairman, I think I think for some of the regions that's true. I think as Mr. Twomley said, in the Bristol Bay area and the money fisheries, it's not a 99% kind of situation. It's more of a 50%, and that is certainly where the loss of permits or the attrition of permits out of Alaska.
I forgot about Bristol Bay.
Yeah.
Other questions for Jeff?
Mr. Chair, I apologize.
Yeah, no problem. We made that arrangement earlier, and we understand. Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you sort of speak to the comment that if this legislation were enacted, each CDQ group could own one permit in, I assume, each limited entry fishery? So that's essentially each. Is that the way I'm interpreting this? I don't know. Maybe I should go to Mr. Tromley, but it's actually a combination because you're the CDQ. But let's just look down the road and say that this is in act and under the way the legislation is. The CDQ group could only own one permit for every fishery where a limited entry permit is issued. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, I'm
a little closer, so I'll get you on the mic, Bruce.
I believe that's correct in a literal reading of the bill right now.
So, essentially, how many limited entry permit fisheries do we have?
Oh, there would be several. There would be at least
26.
But I think I'm guessing.
I don't think that's the intent of the legislation.
No, I understand that, but I'm just theorizing. It's contemplating. So,
that I guess probably wouldn't be worth the effort. It wouldn't be very significant. But I guess I was assuming that was a mistake, and it was intended that the CDQ group could hold more. Could actually be a player in the fishery and hold
more. More than one.
Yeah. I assume that was just a drafting mistake.
So Kelly, even I see you, Kelly. Yeah. So even if. Even if the CDQ entity could only hold one, would you still be in opposition? So your real opposition in the way the legislation is written now is that the CDQ is recognized as an individual.
I'm concerned about that, and I'm concerned about the broad opportunity for an entity to hold limited entry permits. I mean, there are some limited exceptions now for cost recovery permits and educational permits in the Act, but there is this basic bias in the Act from the beginning, for I think sound reasons, that fishing privileges ought to be restricted to real live individual fishermen and not go to entities. And I'm worried about opening the door. I'm worried about the slippery slope, the additional pressures that might create for more entities to move in and hold limited entry permits. And even if it's confined to CDQ holding limited entry permits, even though, I mean, CDQs are a very wholesome and constructive thing, one of the best things that's ever happened to Western Alaska, if CDQs can hold limited entry permits, it does interpose a corporation between a fisherman and the fisherman's rights. The fisherman becomes an employee of the corporation as opposed to somebody who can make his or her own decisions about prosecuting a fishery. So I would be concerned about that.
Thank you.
Assuming we work through legal questions, is there any cap we could put on this to make you feel a little more comfortable? Let's say 10%. The CDQ can not own more than 10% of the permits available in the area.
I'm concerned about the principle because it's such
just
a
departure. Look,
I just want to, again, I'm theorizing here, but and it goes back to Mr. White. You know, the CDQ group is given special recognition in federal law, and a CDQ group sort of has benefits of certain state laws, but it's not recognized in the event in the Limited Entry Commission in of these special recognitions. But some of the Mr. Bush, maybe you can some of the regulations the CDQ group operates under is they can invest only in entities that participate in the harvesting of fish, is that correct?
That's correct right now. It's actually that particular provision is actually under review by the North Pacific Fisheries Council right now to possibly allow a small percentage of in-region general economic development investments instead of just fisheries. But that's under review by the council right now.
I have lots of questions, but and they're all over the map. I'll hold until I can refine them a little bit better. Thank you.
This will probably be more focused in the CS that we come up with. All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Jerry McClune, your last one here, then we'll go to teleconference. We'll start in Dillingham when we get through with this next testifier. So Robert Hano will be first up.
My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska, Mr. Chairman. We had a long talk about when we were writing our bills to consolidate fleets about entities owning permits at UFA, and UFA doesn't want to see any entity hold a permit, whether it's a CDQ group or anything else. We're scared that it'll jump over to, there's other processes in the state, as we all know, which would love probably to own permits themselves. Don't need to, they can have their own boats. We can all go back to 1, 2, and 3 numbers that we used to have when we fished for the canneries. But I think that's the biggest problem we had, is when the drafters of the limit entry law drafted the law, they were pretty smart to keep it in the individuals' names so that those permits would stay in Alaska. And the biggest opportunity that Bristol Bay does have right now is to start buying those permits back, as Mr. Trombley talked about. This is a perfect opportunity to put a buying power to get a lot of those permits back to the state. That fishery is developed by the Italians, and a lot of the processes way back when, and there wasn't a lot of locals fishing at that time, which probably they were pretty smart because there were sailboats, but this would be a perfect opportunity to get a lot of those permits back in the state in that region. But at this time, we're against entities holding permits for the various reasons. Other entities probably would like to do the same things. Communities, we're seeing a lot of moves from the federal side. Communities holding IFQs, that's being talked about. Nonprofits holding IFQs, individual fishing quotas. So we feel we'll open the door to a lot of people that would love to have their own boat to be able to fish and bring their some money home to their community or whatever group it may be, processor or whatever.
Okay, questions? All right, thanks, Jerry.
Okay, that's all we have signed up here in Juneau. We have 5 or 6 on teleconference. Robert in Dillingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Robert Hayato in Dillingham.
Thank you, Robert. Let's go to Kodiak. Oliver Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'd like to speak in opposition to SB 329, and I believe that there are other better methods to get permits in local ownership and increase the local ownership in Bristol Bay. But I'm concerned about creating entities that could hold the fishing rights in a state system. Certainly the CDQ groups have numerous partners in various parts of their entities and actions, and certainly probably would be partnering up with processors, and it's a big concern to me that we would end up going backwards on the independence of fishermen and having an open and competitive market if we had a significant number of permits owned by any single entity or group of entities. So I would be opposed to that. And you haven't talked about the other bill, HB 206.
What's next?
Yeah,
we're going to have, that'll be the next hearing we have right after we finish this up.
Well, I guess I'm concerned about the legal issues and not in support of FBC.
Okay, thank you, Oliver. And like I said, House Bill 206 will be next up. We'll have a hearing on that too. So let's go to Homer, and we start with Alan Parks. Decided yet, Alan? Thank you. Michael Haggerty. Kenai, and I'm not going to try to pronounce your name, so go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, hi there, good afternoon. My name is Jakob Ruchow, and I'm testifying to the position of Bill 329, like the rest of the guys before me, because of the be able to own Burma Stew and entities. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. As I stated earlier, we will set this bill aside. It's apparent we have some work to do on it. Once we get the legal issues hammered out, if we can, we'll bring it back up. And we'll make sure copies get out and get distributed before we bring it as a hearing. So, there's that one. Next, we have House Bill 206. This prime sponsor is House Resources Committee. It's an act relating to vessel-based commercial fisheries limited entry system for Bering Sea, Korean hair crab, and scallops, and some more. We will start with the sponsor statement, and then we'll do the same thing. We'll go around to the LIOs. We'll pick up the folks here in Juneau, then go around to the LIOs. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for taking the time to hear 206 today and members of the committee. House Bill 206 history is the legislature. A few years back, a moratorium was placed on hair crab and weather vane scallops in approximately 1996 and 97. The moratorium was reauthorized a few years later, and under the direction of the legislature, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission was asked to come up with a limited entry plan for these two fisheries. Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission needed a different tool than was in the toolbox to come up with a plan. Currently, our limited entry program, as you stated in the last the hearing on the previous bill, limited entry permits must go to an entity, a person. Under this scenario, it was not acceptable to create a limited entry plan for these two fisheries that would not exacerbate the problem. If the limited entry system that we have currently was used, the permits would have had to go to more than one vessel, because all vessels have up to five different permit holders on them. Because these are Bering Sea fisheries, the owner is not usually on board, and under that scenario, you'd need multiple permits. Well, that would have allowed too many entrants to enter the fishery. So the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission felt that if we would modify the system with House Bill 206 and allow a vessel-based permit to take place, the vessels that were involved in the fisheries for the last few years would be the recipients or potential recipients of the limited entry permits that would be made available. So House Bill 206 changes essentially the manner in which your limited entry system can take place by attaching it to the vessel. We heard this bill in House Resources and Fisheries. It's been modified several times because initially the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission wanted a tool that would be utilized for other fisheries. And because of the controversy with deviating from the norm, that is having the entity be the owner of the permit, we thought it best to just limit it to these two fisheries. In other words, this isn't going to be available for Bering Sea King Crab or Tanner Crab, Kodiak, any of the other crab fisheries around the state, or any other fisheries for that permit, for that reason. So this is just limited to these two. So we modified it in resources for that provision. We also had, we also became cognizant of the next generation. Initially, we thought that after the permit is issued to the vessel, the next generation of ownership should go back to an entity. Because of the dynamics of the Bering Sea fisheries, we realized that the owners, like I said, often not on board and can't operate the business from being on board at all times. So we eliminated that provision, and that the entity could be a person, not on the vessel. And that's why those modifications were made in resources this year before we moved it through the House. Mary McDowell from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission is here to answer any questions I can't, as usual. But I think that's the bill in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Senator Stevens.
Can you sort of walk through and briefly through the concept of the LLP versus the state permit and the issue of why the state should let the LLP participants in?
I probably should have Mary up here with the history, and I know there's a few people in the audience that could walk you through it. Joe Kyle, who used to be on the North Council when those things were set up, is also here. I can just say that after the incidents of the one scallop vessel that took the quota a few years ago, there was a drastic measure to put a moratorium on those new entrants into the scallop fishery. The LLP and the federal fisheries is separate in that it is for federal fisheries. This is for state-managed fisheries, and that's why the legislature asked for a limited entry permit or a limited entry plan to be developed specifically for these two fisheries. Any of the other federal fisheries, there's not been a request to do so at this time. But
I understand. Maybe the question I'm getting at, maybe Mary can answer the question. But is she going to have testimony?
She's going to come up here pretty soon.
Save the tough ones.
Well, let me. Are you through?
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Let me just. I had one on Section 3, Drew.
I'm just wondering, Representative Scalzi, you got management of the offshore fisheries, and we're deleting the word scallop fisheries and inserting fishery. And I guess the question is a broad-based one. What else was this going to include besides scallops?
Well, this is just for scallops and hair crab, and that question was brought up also in resources, and I believe it pertains to another part of the bill is why it was changed from scallop fisheries to fisheries. And
okay, we'll save the tough questions for
later. Ask Mary that one, too.
Oh, I know that is.
But it is, I know it is, it's part of the codification of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Other questions? We're letting them off
better.
Okay, thanks. Mary McDowell, then you want to come up and get the hot seat. And do you have some just general testimony first?
I could say a few things about it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mary McDowell, one of the other commissioners at the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. As the sponsor of the bill said, as far as the origins of the bill, this was something the commission was directed to do by the legislature. Specifically, there was language in the hair crab moratorium bill asking us to come back to the legislature with language that would be generic. Originally, that was what we were requested to do, was to come up with a bill that would create this alternative program that would be vessel-based, that could be used in fisheries that did not lend themselves to effective management or effective limitation under our current program. So what we brought back to the legislature was generic legislation creating this alternative program with some specific criteria in it explaining that we would always default to our original program unless the purposes of the Limited Entry Act, conservation and avoiding economic distress among fishermen, if those purposes could not be met under our current program, then we could consider using this alternative program, vessel-based, to limit that fishery. That was the language that we brought back at the legislature's request. And as the sponsor said, in the House Resources Committee, there was considerable testimony, the same sort of testimony that you just heard on Senate Bill 329, with a great concern about moving towards the possibility of a limited entry program based on vessel ownership and ownership by entities rather than by human beings. And as Bruce Twomley just said, the commission feels very strongly that we should always use the vessel or the person-based program when we possibly can. That's something that's been very important to the way Alaska manages its fisheries and empowering fishermen and so on. So we're very supportive of doing that whenever possible. But just as the legislature did when they directed us to do this, we recognize that there may be a few fisheries that the state is faced with managing or limiting that just may not lend themselves very well to limitation under our current program. And the two examples we have of that before us now are Korean hair crab and the weather-vane scallop fisheries. These are very much unlike the kinds of fisheries that the state has had to limit before. These are, you know, Bering Sea fisheries, large boat, currently corporately owned, and for the most part, the owners are not on board. Occasionally they are. Most of them are owned by corporations or partnerships and use hired skippers and relief skippers, so there are a number of different people running the boat over the course of the season. In cases like that, it would be very difficult to do a sensible limitation of those fisheries under our current program. So the Resources Committee on the House side recognized that there is a need to have an alternative program in these two instances that are facing us right now, but the committee was not willing to make that a generic tool that could be used in any other fisheries. So the bill was narrowed down to these two fisheries. The language in the bill still largely reflects the generic bill that we brought before the committee, but the language has been restricted to use only in those two fisheries. The question that arose a few minutes ago on page 9 about the term scallop fisheries being broadened to a fishery in section 3 was a section that was in the original generic bill, but still makes sense to include here. This is just to make it clear in statute that when the state has an opportunity to manage a fishery that the feds are willing to delegate management to the state to run, that we have clear statutory authority to accept that. I think it's always been the state's position that we should manage whatever fisheries we can, and in some instances, the North Pacific Council or the federal government is willing to turn over management of a fishery to the state, and so this is just to make sure that generic language is in there for the state to accept that. So that does not mean that this kind of limitation program could be used in any other fisheries. This is just a related authorization.
A trust me provision, huh?
Well, yes. This does not have really much of anything to do with the entry commission. It's saying state management, that the state would really be the Department of Fish and Game. The state may take management, and of course the spinoff of that is the entry commission could limit a fishery if that came up. But because of the provisions of this bill now, if we were to limit any other fishery that was delegated to the state, it would have to be under our current limitation program.
Okay. Questions?
You had some tough ones from there. You don't let her off this easy.
Where do I start? How many weather vane permits would be issued with this legislation?
Through the chair, I guess it's important to start by recognizing that this bill doesn't limit either of those fisheries. It would just only give us the ability, if and when we were going to limit those, to use this alternative program if necessary. So we haven't done the research to know exactly how we would limit these two fisheries. I think under the moratorium, there, well, somebody else will know the number, there's maybe a dozen boats, I think, in the that have grandfathered into the moratorium.
The LLP moratorium or the state? But you don't have it, so you think it doesn't. How about the hair crab?
I can't remember. Someone else here, Joe may remember. 21.
21 for the hair crab and 21 for the weather vane. So you don't, you say this legislation just enables you to enact to become a part of the CFEC, but
this program actually sets up a framework for a limitation program, just like our current statute sets up a framework for limiting the other way.
So in a sense, having this framework, does that meet the moratorium requirement then?
What does
when the moratorium sunsets?
Right. The hair crab moratorium sunsets in 2003.
And weather vane 04. So if you have this in place without enacting a program, does that meet the requirements to prevent anybody from coming in, or do you have to implement the plan by 03 and by 04?
This would be the enabling legislation. Once this is in place, the commission would have to research both fisheries, determine which program. I mean, this doesn't automatically say we shall limit it under this program. At that point, we would have to determine whether there was any possible way to limit it effectively under our current program.
And then we'd have to make a finding that we have to use this program to limit that fishery, put out a regulatory proposal proposing a limitation, and go through all of that and do an adoption of the program and have that eligibility criteria and have it adopted and in place before the moratorium expired, in order to avoid having an open access fishery happen in the meantime.
Both of these biomasses and the GHLs are all managed by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game under a fisheries management plan from the feds.
No, the details of that would be best asked of Joe Kyle. I think that's true.
But that's the reason why I bring this up is given the recent news that the entire shellfish management plan may be reverted back to federal control voluntarily anyway. Have you conversed with Fish and Game about the potential of that?
I understand that there is some conversation about what to do about management of the fisheries that have been delegated to the state under the current budget situation. But we have to have our tools in place in case we're faced with this management dilemma. I think it's the responsible thing would be to have the tools in place and be prepared to deal with anything that's state managed. And I don't know whether these two fisheries would fall under that or not, if those are truly, these are in state waters. And I
agree with you. I think that we have to be prepared in the event that we have status quo in the management scenario. Yeah.
I think some of that discussion is about where the state has been delegated authority to manage in federal waters. In this case, we're talking about state waters. Feds are already managing scallops. They've done the LLP. Actually, the state is managing, I guess, the scallop fishery, but the
state's
feds
managing
have done licensing.
Right. They've done a license on LLP, and Fish and Game Joe manages Korean stock in the Pribilofs, right?
And scallops. The state is managing the scallops, but the feds have licensed.
So the point I'm trying to make is if we cut Fish and Game from shellfish management, all this is for naught.
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know whether this would be part of that or not, since this is in state waters. We may still have the licensing authority. I don't know.
For inside 3 miles, like we were before Mr. Big, then. Mm-hmm. So essentially we'd go back to that day, then.
The answer to that.
Thank you. I told you I was all over the map.
So, without this bill, you have the moratorium coming off, right? And you have to do something. That's the first fact, right? And without this bill, you would do what? Could you issue limited entry permits to the individuals under current law and not do vessels?
I guess the dilemma we would be faced with would be to decide that we couldn't effectively manage and let it go back to open access, which could result in the department closing the fishery if they felt that was too risky. I guess the other option would be to explore whether there would be a way to limit it using our existing program, whether we could get the numbers down to something that was sensible, and I guess a policy call for the legislature is the fairness question of issuing permanent fishing privileges to those who've been hired skippers rather than an investment in the boat. And that's
what most of this comes down to, is that policy.
And how many, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, how many anticipated permits would that be?
We haven't done the research to know exactly what the, we'd have to research all the ownership patterns, who's had interim use permits to be skippers, which qualifying years you look at. I don't know the exact numbers.
Okay, thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Go to John Winther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Winther, lifelong Alaskan, currently a resident of Petersburg. I've been a commercial fisherman since 1964, and starting here in Southeast, expanded in the Bering Sea with the crab vessel in 1973. And that vessel has operated in most of the crab fisheries one time or another since that time to current time. The Bering Sea is a unique area in the sense that its majority of whatever fisheries you're in is majority non-owner operated. It's company-owned boats, or if an individual like myself owns a boat, he hires other people to run it. The crab fisheries, all of the crab fisheries are currently under a rationalization program under the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, except for this Korean hair crab fisheries, which is under state management that was delegated to them some time ago. For that reason is why we're asking for this bill to create a vessel license through the state, and that it has to be with authorization from the legislature. The reason being is that under the current system, and I speak for about 15 of the 21 boats that are there, we've all had different owners on board. We see no way that with a personal license permit that we can get the number of permits down to where it would be a rational number they could have the fisheries, as Mary just said. In effect, you would be expanding the effort because of multiple skippers, and that just isn't the thing to do. Another situation is with the large cost of entering the Bering Sea fisheries, you have in a vessel, and then you have a guy that owns a permit that doesn't have any interest in the vessel. The vessel owner is held hostage to the guy that has the license. If he chooses not to go on your vessel, your vessel sits at the dock. If it's a vessel license, then you can get anybody to run the vessel. So we have all the investment and all the risk, yet no license to fish under the current entry system. So for that reason, we need a vessel license up there. Another thing is this Korean hair crab fisheries. It's a small fisheries that takes place in the middle of Bering Sea up around the Perloff Islands in the middle of the year, or middle of the winter from November to January. Currently the stocks are fairly low. There isn't much effort, but it's been has a history of fluctuations, and we're at a low cycle now, and probably we'll start to rebuild and it'll create more interest in the fisheries. Right now there isn't that many boats go up there. It just isn't economical to do it. At this point in time, every vessel that's qualified to fish is a catcher vessel. All the product they catch is taken to Alaska shoreside plants, processed in-state. The state derives the fish tax off of it, and the job's created. So for that reason, we like to protect the fisheries as it is. Of the fleet of vessels, the current type of vessel. So if the moratorium expires, there's nothing taking place, this thing will shift to an offshore fisheries where you get to catch processors involved, and the state sees little or nothing from the benefit of this fisheries that it does now or when the stocks are up. Of the Bering Sea fisheries, by far, the majority out-of-state owned. In this particular little fisheries, which is small in comparison, I looked at the list of boats, and it looks to me like approximately 24% of these boats, 25% of these boats are owned by people in Alaska. And in the probably the larger crab fleet, I would guess maybe 5 or 10% are owned by Alaskans. So I know this is a departure from the way the state of Alaska has done business, but it's not unique to the Bering Sea because of all the non-owner vessels up there that are currently run by the boats under the federal system. And if this does expire and it goes back to the federal management, you don't want it there. And by the time it gets something implemented under the federal system, new entrants have come into being, and they won't be able to manage the fisheries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, John. Questions? Hey, thanks. Jim Stone or Storr? After this, we'll go to Kodiak LIO, so you guys can be close to the mic there. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jim Stone from the scout vessel Ocean Hunter. We've been fishing off the coast of Alaska for 15 years. Ten of those were in state waters. After the moratorium, we've been excluded from state waters. There has been a federal LLP put together, but we do have a license there, and we fish exclusively 3 miles off of the state. 80% of the scallop beds are off the state waters. Despite that, we're still in support of 206 and hoping that CFEC, when they get together, will knock heads and put us back in state waters where we were before. The LOP vessel license limitation has done nothing but a bunch of good things for us. We've been able to form a co-op. All the boats work together well. We voluntarily hired Sea State to keep watch on our crab bycatch. Therefore, our crab bycatch has gone way down. And safety issues, we don't go out in storms and fish anymore. We're no longer racing for fish. It's been a good thing, and we just like to see the state basically mirror what the federal government has done in the federal waters. And that's about it. Any questions?
Questions? There are none. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Okay, Oliver and Kodiak. Oliver, home.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm concerned about the precedent set in 206 where you have a vessel limit-based limited entry system. Essentially, you're going to entities getting the rights to harvest the fish. The federal, or I believe, the concentration of ownership, and it would be very hard to track with a reduced budget. The Energy Commission would be put in a position to, if they were going to track the concentration of ownership in the fisheries that were using this bill, they'd have to create a new bureaucracy to track the ownership. And we found in the health of the fishery that that's exceedingly difficult. The scallop fishery is already handled under a federal LLP, and really it's not necessary to have a state limited entry at all unless the state were to choose to open state waters on a separate fishery, which they haven't done. The Korean air crab fishery is fairly small, and Fox's solo now is relatively insignificant. There's corporate loaned boats, but owned by partnerships and three and smaller groups and other fisheries, and we have a fishery in Kodiak, the Cantercraft fishery, that will be looking at limited entry, or people have asked for it already. And I guess the major concern that as soon as you have any fishery after this bill passes that has any corporate owned boat, it would demand that they get corporate ownership of the permit and then change the character of any fishery in the future that would have the permits. The federal system has vessels and corporations, and I guess that's fine for those fisheries, but I think that under state policy and where the state has control, there's a lot of reasons to keep it an owner, the actual person has the permit. I've seen in the scallop fishery that the owners primarily live out of state, and you want the ownership of the fishing rights where a certain percentage, large percentage of the profit goes to be out of state, not be an actual person. You're going to look at more of the money going out of state. If you keep it as individuals, even non-residents that come up here as individuals and actually have to fish here, probably have a home here, contribute to the economy, and spend at least a good portion of the money there in Alaska. So I think as a policy for the state, vessel-based limited entry creates several problems. Thank you.
Hey, Oliver. Chris Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in opposition to House Bill 206. The salmon model of limited entry has benefits to the state through local jobs and local economies, and the multiplier effects into the economy of Alaska. And that's why you're given a limited entry permit. Benefits will not be the same in an absentee owner permit system. If this type of system is to be adopted by the legislature or the state, they should levy a royalty tax on the resource and receive the direct revenue into the general fund instead of the indirect benefit of the salmon model. I suggest that the resource needs to be treated more like oil than salmon if this corporate absentee owner model is adopted. I think the air crab, you guys in the former bill 329, there was concern in the Bristol Bay fishery that 51% of the drift permits are owned by non-residents, and the aircraft fishery, only 25% are owned by residents. It's not true that there is owner-operators in the Bering Sea fishing crab. It would be nice if my wife and myself own a two salmon permits, and I would love to move out of Alaska for you know, to change the state's policy on how they issue entry permits. And so I pretty much got some real problems with 206, and I would hope that you would yourself be a little bit easy on this deal and take her slow. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go to Kenai to Yaakov.
Yeah, hi there. Yaakov Rutov again. I guess I don't really have anything very much that I'm opposing for most of the same reasons for the Senate House Bill 1339. So,
okay.
You guys should just really take it slow and easy enough to change the language in your bill. So, that's all I have.
All right, thank you, sir. Okay, let's go to Homer, Alan Parks.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Alan Parks, and I'd just like to restate that I am a commercial fisherman, an active commercial fisherman, and I also work for Alaska Marine Conservation Council, and none of the views that I express now have or will be consistent with Alaska Marine Conservation Council. So I appreciate it. You take note of that, because I am speaking on my own. I oppose House Bill 206 for a lot of reasons, and I think as somebody who has participated in the fisheries, in a variety of different fisheries, on a variety of different sized vessels, I think one of the things that stick to my core is something that the sponsor wrote in his statement of last year, dated 3/21 of 2001. And it's in the third paragraph, last sentence, that says, further, if with award ongoing fishing privileges to many who have worked essentially as hired crew and not those who have invested in the fishery. And I think what, in all due respect to the sponsor, and why I take somewhat a little bit to this statement, is that it belittles my involvement as somebody who takes a fishing vessel into Alaska waters as a hired skipper, manages the crew, decides where to fish, decides when to come to town, decides all the working operations of that vessel at sea, and that is worth something. And I leave my family in port. I'm really think that this is why limited entry laws went to independent fishermen. This is why they got rid of fish traps and went to independent fishing families and fishermen. So I guess by saying essentially that I'm just a hired crew, that by giving the rights to the resource to vessel owners, I become merely a sharecropper. And I think that is not the intent of limited entry laws. And I think that all these same arguments that are being made for the herring fishery and the scallop fishery can be made for any fishery in the state of Alaska. And so I really would appreciate it if you folks, in your wisdom, very slowly on this and looked at the big picture. And I do respectfully disagree with this language of this bill, the intent of this bill, and hope that you both know
on
it. So thank you very much.
Okay. Malcolm Milne.
Yes, my name is Malcolm Milne. Again, Homer. Also a commercial fisherman here. I'm opposed to Senate Bill 329. As a participant in the scallop fishery, I just feel like it's important that the fishing rights go to the people who are fishing and not to those who are at the dock or out of state just collecting the money. Important that these resources are shared among the people who are actually doing the fishing, and I feel like there's other ways of, you know, limiting the actual catches and managing the resources rather than just giving all the control to the boat owners. So again, I oppose Senate Bill 206 or House Bill 206, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Michael Haggerty next.
Yeah, good afternoon again. My name is Michael Haggerty. I oppose House Bill 206
Thank you. That's all we have for public testimony. We will set this bill aside and come back to it later. For those of you that may have joined us, we don't have a quorum, so we're taking public testimony today. We won't be taking any action on any bills. But I didn't want to cancel the meeting and have you go to the LIOs and not be able to testify. Okay, next we have House Bill 298. Prime sponsor is Representative Murkowski. It's an act relating to authorizing the Alaska Railroad Corporation to lease land for a period up to 55 years. Staff's here, Robin Phillips, tell us all about it. You told me it was that long. It's really long. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robin Phillips, and I'm legislative aide to Representative Lisa Murkowski. At the request of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, Representative Murkowski introduced House Bill 298, extending the length of time the Alaska Railroad Corporation can lease lands from the current 35 years to 55 years. This change in statute will help improve economic development in communities along the rail belt by making commercial and residential development on the Alaska Railroad lands more viable. The current 35-year leases are an obstacle in leasing lands to large commercial and residential developers who need to secure long-term financing for their investments. Financial lenders are reluctant to invest in large-scale projects requiring substantial participation when there's no guarantee the land will be available beyond 35 years. House Bill 298 will also make the Alaska Railroad Corporation leasing practices more consistent with other state agencies. Both the University of Alaska and the Department of Natural Resources can lease lands for up to 55 years. The proposed extension of allowable lease term is supported by Alaska businesses, chambers, and cities. Wendy Linskoog from the Alaska Railroad Corporation is here today and available for any technical questions. And I ask for your support on this legislation.
Okay, any questions? Pretty straightforward. We do have Jim Kubitz online to testify for the railroad. Well, Jim, you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Senator. I have Bill Hubbard, our legal counsel here, also, and Karen Morrissey from the Real Estate Department. I'm here mostly to answer any questions if you have any about it. We've had a couple of hearings on this in the House, and there really hasn't been much controversy about it. This is coming from a demand from our tenants and our leaseholders who really are looking for longer terms to lease land. Some new tenants are out there looking for some developments, and that's where this is coming from. We would appreciate your support on it.
Okay. Any questions for any of the railroad staff? Okay, there are none. I think it's pretty straightforward. It would have moved today if we'd had a quorum, but we'll have to bring it up at one of our other meetings and move it out. So thanks, Jim, and everybody there for coming out to testify.
We're here. Thank you, sir.
I don't know of any opposition either, just so nobody's expressed any to me anyway.
Yet.
Okay, that brings us next to House Bill 131. This is an act relating to standards for forest resources and practices and providing for an effective date. Prime sponsor is who? The governor. Oh, hi. Prime is introduced by rules at the request of the governor, and Carol Carroll's here with DNR to walk us through it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is, for the record, Carol Carroll, and I am representing the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do is just give an overview of what the process that the Board of Forestry requested all of the agencies and some of the affected groups to go through to get this bill to you today. And then I would like, with your permission, to invite Marty Wellborn up here, who's the technical expert and can give you certainly answer the questions and give you some of the technical changes that have taken place within the bill. What the bill does is identify the riparian standards for Region 3. The Board of Forestry requested the science and technical subgroup to get together and identify all of the best science. when that occurred, we got together with an implementation group and with all of the affected parties to make sure that what we were looking at in the scientific and technical group really would work on the ground. After that, that process was completed, we brought the bill back to the Board of Forestry for their review, and that bill is what you see before you today. Some key points in the bill's development are that the process was based on, like I said, the best available scientific information. The process was open to the public throughout, and it involved a wide variety of interests at each step. There were scientists, the timber and fishing industries, environmentalists, the Board of Forestry, and experienced field staff from state and agencies all participated. What you have before you, Mr. Chairman, is a consensus bill. That concludes my testimony, and with your permission, I would like to invite Marty Wellborn to the table.
You signed up?
She did indeed.
Okay. So what's
questions?
The difference between this and the Area 2 and Area 1 that we did?
Area 1 is coastal Alaska. Area 3 is the interior, and Area 2
is... We haven't done Area 2, have we?
No, we have not.
We have? One shaking her head yes, the other one no.
That's
I have not done it.
That's next.
So what's different between this and the other one we did? Area 1.
Between this and Region 1, shall I introduce myself first? I'm Marty Wellborn Freeman with the DNR Division of Forestry, and I was the co-chair of the Science and Technical Committee that developed this and the implementation group with the stakeholders. In terms of the difference between this and Region 1, we have a different stream classification system in the interior that's tailored to the stream types there. So in Region 1, we have four different stream types. They include both anadromous streams, of which there are two types, and then tributaries to anadromous streams. In the interior, the streams that we deal with are both anadromous and high-value resident fish streams, and they're subdivided between the non-glacial waters and the glacial waters.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Senator Stevens, questions?
No, I had the opportunity to speak with her earlier, so all my concerns were addressed.
Okay. We'll go to teleconference then. You guys can sit through today. Nobody else has signed up, so. Alderman Fairbanks, Bob Zackel.
Yes, that's me.
Go for it, Bob.
Okay. My name is Bob Zackel. I was the interior timber industry representative on the Science and Technical Committee when we had this meeting and worked on this. The only thing I wanted to say, I've had some concerns, and through the Division of Forestry talked to some people. I just wanted to make it clear that what I thought I was getting from this agreement was that fish and game must present clear scientific data to justify the objections to sales beyond the 100-foot setback. I've been talking to Fish and Game Habitat, the representative here, and there doesn't seem to have a problem with that. I suppose maybe there was some matter of implementation at some point between forestry and fish and games. Maybe some of the communication could have been better at times, but I just wanted to make sure that that 100-foot setback burden of proof would be on fish and game after the 100-foot setback.
So you have an automatic 100-foot. Are you talking about the next 100-foot or the 100-foot up the stream bed?
There's a 100-foot from the bank of the stream in 100 feet.
Okay. And you want Fish and Game to do what?
After that 100 feet, Fish and Game would present clear scientific data to justify their objections to a sale beyond that 100-foot, or is that first 100-foot setback.
Okay. 15, it's 9 to
17, he's got right down here. That's to help make these sales go through easier. That keeps the number of sales up. It helps keep the price of stoppage down.
Okay. We'll try to. You say that your talks with Fish and Game, they're okay with it?
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have any problem with that.
He And you'd rather, you'd like to see something in statute instead of just have a promise from Fish and Game?
Well, I would actually, yes.
Okay. I thought that's what you were asking for.
I'm not real good at this.
No, that's okay. You're doing fine. We were looking on page 3, lines 15 through 18. It looked like it, but it has with due deference to the Department of Fish and Game. And
it goes on the paper.
Yeah. You got to have your slide rule to understand this thing. It's all the type 1s and C's and B's. And seems like we could write things up a little clearer than this. But anyway, I'll look at that for you, Bob, and we'll see what we can do.
Okay.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Also in Fairbanks is James Durst. Okay, well, hopefully you're sitting right close to Bob, and you guys can shake hands and work this out. And
well, we've been talking for about 2.5 hours now, and I think actually he needs to go back to work, so he's about out of here. But okay. Yeah, we've been working on it.
Okay, well, let's see if we can get some consensus on that issue, and because you know, a big partner in this is the industry itself, and if you don't have them on board, you won't have me. All right, any questions for Mr. Durst? Okay, there are none. Let's go to Beth Cassie, I think. Cassie?
My name is Beth Casey, and
oh, Casey.
I live in Fairbanks. I'm representing the Northern Alaska Environmental Center. The Northern Center would like to testify in favor of the passage of House Bill 131. We support this bill not only because it would provide a higher level of protection for riparian habitats and the fish that depend on them here in the interior, but also because we support the process by which this bill was drafted. The bill is based on the best available science as collected by a specially convened scientific committee, together by extensive group of stakeholders that included fishers, loggers, native interests, conservationists, and state agency representatives. A representative of the Northern Center, not me, but somebody else, took part in the stakeholder process. Like everyone else who worked together to resolve this, she had to make compromises, incorporate the viewpoints and considerations of others. Because of this fine balance struck in this kind of consensus-based compromise, we ask that the Senate Resources Committee pass this bill without amendment. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, let's go to Anchorage. Our last testifier, Jill Klein. Klein, where?
Gone.
Oh, go ahead. Don't worry about that one, then. That's all we have for testimony today, so we will set that bill aside also. And that concludes our agenda for today. We have no meeting scheduled on Friday, so we will next, we'll set the schedule tomorrow. So for Monday, I'll tell you, I won't be bringing up 131 on Monday. I want to take some time to review that a little closer. But we'll probably bring up the railroad bill so we can get out of here. But anyway, we'll take a look at that schedule later. Anything else? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.